Here's the real question.
I don't remember how we used to start this show. this is the intro now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Out of Phase, presented by PSPS. It's been a minute. We're back. We're doing a new podcast. We kind of got burnt out. We kind of ran out of ideas. And, you know, we're students, so we're students. We have limited time. But we wanted to do this again. We really enjoyed making it. But we're changing it up a little bit. We wanted to change up the format. We wanted to change up the topic so that it was a little bit more viable for the sake of, you know, week-to-week stuff. Because I know that I personally, in hosting the first iteration of this podcast, struggled with coming up with a topic every week. Coming up with a song that I was passionate and nostalgic about every week was pretty difficult. So we're going to be doing this less frequently. We're going to start off month to month. It might increase from there. It might not. It's kind of a test run right now. And instead of talking about stuff we're passionate about, we are going to be talking about music history. So we're changing the format a little bit. We're changing the style. We're changing the frequency. We are going to be releasing this. We're going to start once a month. It's going to come out the first weekday of the month for this term. So we'll have this one. We'll have another one this term. And then we'll see. We might stay on the monthly schedule. We might move more towards bi-weekly. It depends on a couple of behind-the-scenes factors. And we're changing the topic, like I said. So we're going to talk more about music history instead of stuff that we're passionate about, because I, as the host of the show, I really like music history. I find music history quite fascinating, and I like talking with my coworkers about it and, you know, other people. So every month, I'll be the host. I'll have one of my coworkers, one of our friends of PSPS, come on the show, and we'll talk about a piece of music history that we find interesting. This week, we've got a guest of ours, one of our coworkers, Storm Garrison. Hi, Storm.
Hi.
How's it going?
I'm doing pretty good.
Nice. I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us what you do at PSPS. What's your job here?
Well, I mean, I guess technically it's entry level, right? Sound technician.
Yeah.
Sort of. I mean, I help assist setting up events. I've done a little lighting, but mostly it's running around and miking things and plugging and unplugging cords in the right spots.
Nice.
And just... at least for me, you know, I try to provide some comedic relief.
That's the real reason.
I feel like that's an
you.
Important part of my job.
Yes, correct. What kind of music are you into? What like draws you to the music area of work and stuff like that?
What draws me most is experiencing new things. I grew up almost entirely listening to rock and metal, and that persisted mostly through high school. I got into a little rap and electronic. But over the past 6-7 years, I've really, really just gotten into all kinds of music. It's just more that there's a filter. It's either I like it or I don't, but that's not dependent on genre or style.
Right.
So basically everything, but I feel like I have to explain because I've known so many people that they're like, oh, I listen to everything. And all that means is they just aren't that into music.
Right. Yeah. They're not like super picky
for me,
about it.
I'm always actively trying to find new things I haven't heard to listen to.
Sweet. Well, we're going to talk about something really cool this week. And we've Storm thought this was deliberate, and I just mentioned this to him. This was not deliberate on my part, but we've kind of created a Halloween episode. You'll probably be listening to this in November because it'll come out on the 2nd. But we're recording this on the 29th, so a couple days before Halloween. We're talking about this week Robert Johnson, a blues legend, with a very, very specific dark myth tied to him. And how that kind of influenced rock from there on out. Because Robert Johnson is someone that influenced rock on a musical level, but also this kind of urban legend around him influenced a lot of conceptions and like figures in rock and stuff like that. So Robert Johnson was a blues guitarist in the early 1900s. He is really widely known now as a master of the craft of Delta blues. and is someone that has had a lot of influence on like early rock musicians, like members of the Rolling Stones and Jimi Hendrix and a lot of people in that era. But he wasn't very famous during his lifetime and really didn't become so until after his death in the mid-1930s, if I'm not mistaken. But Johnson was born in Hazelhurst, Mississippi in May of 1911. Some people put May 8th, but it seems pretty speculative. He was born actually out of wedlock to a woman who had cheated on her husband, and so he never actually knew his birth father growing up. He actually moved to Memphis, Tennessee from Hazelhurst when he was pretty young after his stepfather was forced out of town by a lynch mob due to some land dispute with white landowners in the area, which is pretty dark. And eventually his mother left his stepfather and remarried someone, and they moved back to Mississippi. So he spent a lot of his childhood in Mississippi and a little bit in Arkansas, if I'm not mistaken, and in Memphis, Tennessee. So in the South, in the, you know, bluesy region of the world at the time, and, you know, still today. He also, I think it's kind of evident by that story, it had not a great childhood. Like, it didn't seem like he got along great with his first stepdad, and certainly didn't with his second. So he had a rough childhood, but he learned to play the guitar a little bit, learned music from like his brothers. He was actually pretty good at the harmonica, which is something that I thought was interesting. So he actually learned to play the harmonica as a kid and continued to play it through his adulthood and was good at it.
I think the rough childhood probably makes sense as to why he gravitated more towards a blues.
Right. Style. Yeah. I mean, especially the Delta blues, which is that real sad, slow stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when Johnson was in his 20s, a relatively famous blues musician named Son House moved to the area of Mississippi that he was from and would play in like local, you know, venues and stuff like that with his musical partner at the time. And Johnson would go watch this because he loved music. He loved the blues. And I thought this was kind of funny. In between sets, he would ask Son if he could like play his guitar, like just play around with it. And really? Son House seemed like a pretty nice guy, so he would like let him. And I heard this old recording, probably from like the 50s or 60s or something like that, of Son House describing Johnson playing his guitar at that time. And he was like, he was awful. He was so bad. Like he would play it and people would be like, can you get him to stop playing it? It's so embarrassingly bad.
Wow.
Yeah. It was like pretty brutal the way he described this old man at the time of the recording, describing how Robert Johnson in his early 20s was just a terrible, terrible guitarist.
I wonder if it was just bad or if it was bad because it was different, you know, like if it was awful or just stylistically not what
well I mean, if you think about it, Son House is also a Delta blues guitarist, so it must have been similar to some extent, but
I would think so.
Yeah, it seemed that people in these venues really, really did not think that Johnson was a great guitarist, and which is interesting because, you know, he ends up being this like master of the discipline, right? Like this person that posthumously everyone looks towards.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit of one of the greatest electric bassists is Victor Wooten. And Victor Wooten was taught by his brother how to play the bass. Mm-hmm. And Victor taught his brother how to play the electric guitar. So it's funny because Victor is one of the greatest electric bassists, at least contemporarily speaking.
Right.
And his brother is just an awful, like god-awful guitarist. It's really funny.
That's so good.
Yeah.
So after, you know, this thing with Johnson where he would come and see these shows and, you know, mess around on the guitars and stuff like that and people would complain, he kind of disappeared from the area for a couple of years. There's some like no one really knows what he was doing. He was kind of a mysterious guy as well. People don't really know a lot about him. And actually, there's only two like actual photos that are verified to be of him, which I found pretty interesting.
Really?
As well. Yeah, there's only two of them. And if you've ever seen them, one of the things, total tangent, but I always think about this when I think of Johnson, is that some people think he had what's called Marvin syndrome, which makes you really tall and skinny with like super long limbs. And like long appendages and stuff like that. So in these pictures of him, he has these like monstrously long fingers, like these like really long, really thin fingers that make it look like it would probably like affect his ability to play the guitar, or like his way of playing the guitar. But if you've never seen what he looks like, Google Robert Johnson. There's only two real pictures of him. So like,
I'm looking at
him. Yeah, look him up now. Right now. His fingers. Tell me about his fingers, Storm.
I've seen pictures of him before, but I hadn't really keyed in on it. But now that you mention it, yeah, his fingers, they remind me of a friend of mine who's also an insane guitarist, but as far as I know, doesn't have Marvin syndrome. He just has disproportionately long arms and fingers.
Right.
Lucky bastard.
And he was, my understanding is that Johnson was a pretty tall, skinny guy as well. So that could lead to that hypothetical diagnosis or whatever. But anyway, yeah, he was big, tall, skinny guy with big hands and long fingers.
Kind of like spider.
Exactly.
They remind me of almost of spider legs.
This is what my dad has told me about Robert Johnson, is that he had like spider-like hands. This is why I know about this, and my dad told me about this. But so anyway, he disappeared for a couple of years. Kind of a weird, mysterious guy. Not a ton known about him. Some people think that in this time he was going to try to find his birth father. I'm not sure. It seems like people don't really know. But he came back after these like two-ish years to where Sunhouse was playing and was a master guitarist in 2 years. Just better than Sunhouse. Amazing prodigy at the guitar.
Totally out of nowhere, huh?
Yeah. I mean, in 2 years, right? Like that's crazy.
Yeah.
And so this is where we get into the thing that makes this kind of a Halloween episode, because in the 70s, people were trying to figure out how you could do that, how you could go away for 2 years being totally terrible at the guitar and then all of a sudden come back and be a literal master guitarist. Mm-hmm. In the 1970s, a rumor appeared to explain this, like I'm saying, and the story goes that Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil so that he could be good at the guitar, which is crazy. Like that's a wild rationalization of that. But here's like the full story of it. So apparently one night in, you know, somewhere in this area, Mississippi, Tennessee, Arkansas, that kind of area of the country, Johnson goes out to a crossroads at midnight and is playing his guitar. And at midnight, the devil shows up and is like, it basically offers him this deal. So the devil tunes his guitar and plays a song and then hands the guitar back to Johnson. And in accepting that guitar, he agrees to a contract. That contract being, you become a master guitarist, you become this prodigy, but I own your soul now, and you will die an untimely death. Obviously, this came way after the fact. This idea, this story shows up like 50 years after Johnson's death. But Johnson's death was in the 30s at the age of 27. So
he did die young.
He died really young. He died, you know, only a couple of years after he comes back as this amazing guitarist. So that, coupled with the fact that apparently, you know, like eyewitness accounts or whatever, people said that his personality changed, that he became like angry and like upset and like just kind of moody guy. And
I do think what I have learned about Johnson previously was that he, I don't know if it's speculation or if it was confirmed, but I think he had some substance abuse problems.
Yeah, that's another thing.
He was an alcoholic. Well. Or
like after he had come back.
Yeah, so this, maybe that was also tied into the mood.
Right. I mean, one of the things about Johnson is like, if you really look at it, and not to be like a reductionist and reduce it down to like one idea, but his life seemed pretty rough. Like it seemed like it sucked quite a bit.
Other than his skill on the guitar.
Right. He seemed like he had a shit upbringing, despite the fact that he was an amazing guitarist, really gained nothing out of it. He went to two recording sessions to record some stuff. There's only like 29 songs of his that ever were recorded.
Which kind of like, makes it even more impressive just how influential he's been when there's, it's exactly almost like Jimi Hendrix.
Exactly, exactly.
Such a small repertoire to pull from, but they're so different from what was being done at the time.
Exactly. They've
just influenced so many things.
So Johnson supposedly sells his soul to the devil, comes back, is a master guitarist, records some songs, goes on a little bit of kind of a tour up to the Chicago area of the country, and then dies a couple years later at the age of 27. And he's also the first like listed member of the idea of the 27 Club. And if you're not familiar with the 27 Club is this idea that like a bunch of really talented, mostly musicians, but some other artists as well, die at the age of 27. And that's Johnson is the first one, but that also includes Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, Janis Joplin, Brian Jones, Jim Morrison. Like it's a pretty long list of people.
That's how I know I'm not that talented, because I just turned 28 this year in September. So I was just reading about it. I was like, damn, missed my chance to be an amazing, influential artist. I've lived too long now.
I might die at 27. I probably won't. I'm not that talented. So, but anyway, he's like the first like popular figure in that, chronologically speaking, in that group to die at 27. Obviously, that's like. The thing that I want to acknowledge about this is like it is not a very well sourced piece of history, if that makes sense. Like it's not well documented, especially the idea of him selling his soul to the devil. And one of the things about this story that always like I think it's interesting, obviously, and it's this like great like urban legend, pop culture, and it's also a play on the like Faustian legend of like a man sells his soul to the devil to get something from the devil. But if you really think about it, right, believing this story would require A, excusing that it's not very well sourced, B, believing in the devil, which some people do, some people don't, and C, believing that if there is a devil, he comes to Earth to make bargains with individuals for whatever reason, right? Like,
yeah.
Right.
To add on to that just a bit, I do think, of course, you know, not trying to present this from the standpoint of like, oh, it's totally true, but it's always fun to, it's always fun to speculate
sure, yeah,
right. And it is always funny when you think, like, taking the 27 Club as an example, it seems like whenever you do talk about the occult or something related, there is all these weird coincidences that somehow line up in a way that makes it seem like there could be more to the story,
right? And that's
make anything true, but it's interesting,
right? That's what sells the story too. But the thing with Johnson that to me is almost a little heartbreaking, right, is that for most people, if they know who Johnson is, which, you know, a lot of people probably don't. I mean, those people who are interested in music history probably do. But for most people, Robert Johnson is not prodigal guitar or, you know, like amazing master guitarist Robert Johnson. He's that guy who sold his soul to the devil to be really good at guitar, Robert Johnson. And if you think about it, it's probably more likely that he was just really dedicated to learning how to be a good guitarist. So, you know, assuming he's probably spent those 2 years traveling, he spent those 2 years becoming an amazing guitarist. So it's really sad that his legacy is this urban legend instead of the fact that it follows from reason that he would have had to have been like an incredibly smart, talented, dedicated person to be able to accomplish that feat.
Right.
That's the thing that to me, like, it's a great urban legend and it's a great, like, spooky story, but it's also like he actually did for real learn how to play the guitar really well, aside from any sort of occult thing. So, like, he probably taught himself how to play the guitar very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it sucks that that's not his legacy, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, you'd think after being embarrassed to the point, you would think, you know, he would have taken, obviously he must have taken that quite to heart when people were saying they didn't want him to play on the stage anymore or whatever, if he caught wind of it. And I would say that makes sense that he would kind of go into a sort of shell and not interact with the outside world until he felt he was ready to prove what he was actually capable of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would hope that. It's a shame that he's not able to see the influence that he's had on music, because it's an immense influence, because he's one of those people kind of, I mean, I'm wearing my Pixies t-shirt today, but they kind of are a good example of this as well. Like, he's one of those artists that they themselves were not super popular, but they inspired people that became immensely, like, massive successes. Like, this guy inspired Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones. Like, if you just inspired those two groups of people, you would have done a great service to the world. But, like, absolutely, he did more than that. So I think that it's sad. You know, it's kind of like Van Gogh, right? Like, he became this, like, really famous artist posthumously. And it sucks that he wouldn't have ever been aware of that. So, like,
right.
I love this urban legend, but I also love remembering that, like, Robert Johnson is someone who is very talented.
And way ahead of his time.
Exactly.
With that talent.
So, Storm, I want you to tell me a little bit more about the influence that this urban legend and Robert Johnson had on music towards the modern day.
So one thing, or a few things, I should say, that add to this legend of Robert Johnson selling his soul that I find particularly interesting. One thing from my own personal interests, since I was a child, I've always had like a pretty large interest in the occult to some extent. Like I found it interesting, not necessarily believe everything or, sure. You know, it, right. I have some of my beliefs and I reject a lot of other, you know, things out there. Right. But I find it interesting at its core, real or not. So one thing that I am familiar with is the legend of crossroads demons in general. And it sometimes is presented as the devil. And there's a lot of other cultures that have similar myths. Like I think that I can't remember the name of the figure, but there's like a Haitian one, for instance, but there's a lot of similarities. And it's not necessarily always the devil. Sometimes it's just a specific type of demon, like under the devil or dark right. lord or whatever you want to say is command. And they go specifically to crossroads. And like the legend around Robert Johnson ties into that because you go there after and about midnight, I think is the time, mm-hmm. right? When the clock strikes, a demon will appear and you can sign this contract, like you had stated earlier, where you sell your soul in exchange for something. So a wish of some sort or skills or, you know, I don't know, a car, I don't care, whatever you want. But the caveat is that they get control of your soul. And if you don't return to give them your soul, they will send a hellhound to chase you and take your soul from you by force if you don't try to hold up your end of the contract. So one thing that adds to this Robert Johnson myth is a few of his songs are coincidentally probably, right. but themed very much. He has a song called Me and the Devil Blues.
Yeah.
And that's pretty explicitly related to what we're talking about. One called Crossroad Blues. Now, of course, you know, crossroads are, it doesn't mean right. it has a relation to myth, but it's interesting. And I think the most interesting one is Hellhound on My Tail is another of his songs. So you take those three things and it's easy to see where the
myth comes from.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And it makes it more fun. You're like, wait, but he had a song about hellhounds
totally.
And crossroads and the devil.
Here's the thing in you describing that, my reaction is like to rationalize it, obviously, because I tend to do that.
Right.
And my first thought is, well, okay, like that kind of iconography is like really synonymous with Delta blues, but the thing that I don't know is if that is because of Johnson's legacy or if that is something that has just been in Delta blues music. I don't know a ton about the Delta blues, but like I associate that kind of iconography with that kind of music. So I'm wondering if that's Johnson's legacy or if that's like
a sort of it's sort of right. like a chicken and the egg.
Exactly. Argument, that, yeah, right? That's what I'm
what
trying
came
to
first?
Say. Yeah. That's funny. I didn't research his music other than just kind of like listening to it while we were doing the research. So, yeah, that's that's really funny that those line up so perfectly.
Exactly. It's like I was talking about the weird occurrence, like coincidences that somehow always come into play when we're talking about
right.
the occult or something that adds to the fun, like the 27 Club.
Exactly.
And this Robert Johnson. It's interesting.
I think it's interesting because when I hear this story, it doesn't strike me as a like, oh no, spooky man sold his soul to the devil. It sounds kind of very badass a little bit. Like,
right.
I think it depends on your perspective, on your belief in this kind of stuff. But I think that this idea of like, oh, you sold your soul to the devil to be a sick ass guitarist. That's pretty fucking cool. Like that's
pretty metal.
Right. That's exactly right. Like that idea persists. That idea still persists in rock music. And Storm, you're going to tell us a little bit more about that idea. But first, I'm going to tell everyone a little bit more about what's going on at Portland State and what PSPS is doing right now. So let's do that. So, despite the fact that we're in a pandemic, Portland State Professional Sound, along with some of our partners, are still trying to hold events virtually, of course, because we want to be safe. And we are doing that by continuing our Parkway North Project event series throughout the pandemic. So, if you're not familiar with the Parkway North Project, it is a joint venture by PSPS, Portland State Programming Board, KPSU, which is our college radio, and Fifth Avenue Cinema, which is our on-campus student-run cinema. We put on weekly events on Thursdays of, you know, a variety of things throughout the term. Usually they're put on by one of us, like one of our groups, and it's kind of thematic. But we also do a lot more large-scale group events where we, you know, collaborate and work on ones. So, you know, during the school year, this would be our, you know, Portland State of Mind concert or like a large concert in the winter, stuff like that. If you're not familiar with it, you should go check it out once we get back on campus. But in the meantime, you should also come to our fall term lineup. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the events we've got going on through the rest of November so that you're more aware of them. So on week six, which is the event's going to be on the 5th of November, we have an event hosted by Portland State Programming Board called Data Privacy Part 2. I didn't know there was a part one, but I assume this is an event where you're going to talk a little bit about data privacy. Pretty cool. On the seventh week, on the 12th specifically, PSPS, we're hosting an open mic night via Zoom. Anyone who's Portland State community is welcome to come. It's just going to kind of be a place to hang out and chill and perform whatever you want to perform, you know, poetry, music, that kind of stuff. We'll try to make it through the like lag of Zoom and all that weirdness and stuff like that. It'll actually be hosted by myself, yours truly. In the eighth week, Portland State Programming Board is going to hold an event called Exploring Oregon's Racist History. I think that should be super interesting. It'll be really interesting to talk about, especially because of, you know, we're on what the university frequently calls stolen land. So I think it's a really probably very intellectual, worthwhile conversation. Following that, week nine, completely different tone. We're watching Grease, I guess, the movie. that's hosted by Fifth Ave. I love Grease. I think it's a great musical. I come from theater, so I'm a little biased. But yeah, Grease Netflix party on week nine. That's the 26th. You can find more information about this on all of our individual Instagrams. This poster should be posted on those Instagrams. If it's not already, it should within the coming months. So that's our Parkway North project lineup for the rest of the month. Another thing we've been doing during the pandemic, our production manager, Violet Gibson, has been hosting a show on our Instagram called Behind the Music. She's been talking to local artists, having them do kind of interviews, some performance type stuff. It's really interesting. It's really cool to see local artists. It's giving them an outlet to do stuff right now when there's not really any venues that are open. So you can check that out on our Instagram, which is PS Pro Sound. Our profile picture is our logo, just a PSPS. And that's where you also can find information about this show, about like Behind the Music, about Parkway North Project, and any of our upcoming projects or events, stuff like that. Go ahead and check it out. PS Pro Sound on Instagram. Storm, I want to know more about Robert Johnson's legacy. I want to know more about the legacy of this urban legend. So what do you have for me? What can you tell me about that?
So I did some digging because, like I said, I'd grown up mostly on rock and classic rock and metal and classic metal, you know.
Ooh, but I didn't variety.
Right. but I didn't know a lot. Well, there was also blues and other things, but that was like the real meat and potatoes, as they say. So I was really interested in this personally, and also because I realized I just didn't know where the kind of history of the occult themes being very pervasive in metal and harder versions of rock that led into metal kind of came from. And what I found was not necessarily tied Robert Johnson directly. However, there is a little crossover. So for instance, you mentioned earlier that Robert Johnson was a big influence on the Rolling Stones and Jimi Hendrix, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that I wouldn't say it correlated one-to-one, but the Rolling Stones did release a song in 1968 that is called Sympathy for the Devil.
Right.
And it's not, it doesn't use the devil necessarily from a dark occult standpoint that we're probably more accustomed to at this point. It tells the story of different traumatic events in humanity's history through the perspective of the devil. And so on. And it's more like you're supposed to kind of relate with them, you know, and see things maybe from his point of view and so on. So that might be one of the first references in contemporary music I guess I would still consider that contemporary. It's not really that far off in the span of music.
You're making anyone who listens to this podcast that's older than 30 feel really old, by the way.
I suppose.
I guess the Rolling Stones are contemporary music.
Well, I don't know what's considered. I consider myself kind of old head, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I get you.
You know. Anyway, but the first, what's credited as the first significant reference to Satan from the standpoint of like an occult or dark factor to use that kind of imagery to create a certain feel in the song of being dark or evil or any word you want to throw in there, is actually a band that I maybe had heard of before called Coven, which were an American band actually based out of Chicago. And their debut album in 1969 was called Witchcraft Destroys Minds and Reaps Souls, right? So they were the first band that's believed to have used really occult imagery and themes in their music to get that specific response of like, wow, this is dark, this is scary, this is different, you know, this is shocking, right? They're also the first band credited with the iconic hand sign that's known amongst metal heads and rock of raising the horns, which of
the
course
devil
this
horns,
is a
yeah.
podcast, so you can't see it. But
yeah, you know,
I assume
like
most people would know, but if they don't, it's you know, the I love you symbol in hand in sign language, but then you cross the thumb over the middle two fingers.
Can you give me like a nice like NPR style description of like how one would
you raise the index finger and the pinky straight into the air while simultaneously keeping your middle two fingers curled in. Then you take your thumb and place it over the two curled in fingers and raise it as horns in the heavens. I suppose that's how it is.
That was, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, just like, I'd suppose. Mm-hmm.
So Coven was the first band who did that. At least as far as records show, you know, photographs and stuff. They have photographs that were used in conjunction with the album dated back to 1968. I did see mention of it being used in 1968 Beatles, actually, The Yellow Submarine. But who knows if it was...
Right.
I don't like it the was intention. Not, yeah, think. The intention was totally different. And who knows? I think, you know, but it's credited more to Coven.
The Beatles don't really particularly scream like satanic imagery to me, especially Yellow Submarine of all.
No. But they did come up in some of my research. Nothing specific enough here, but they did involve some occult, like they they meditate, they learned specific types of meditation with a yogi of the time, and kind of brought a little bit of that influence in there. What part of contemporary music did they not influence?
That's a good
part, as rock goes. Anything, you know. But anyway, Dio continued to make it more popular. Its popularity really surged after Ronnie James Dio became the singer of Black Sabbath after 1979, when Ozzy Osbourne left that band. And he would use the devil horns in an attempt to connect with the crowd and his fans more, like Ozzy did. Mm-hmm. But Ozzy used the peace sign, and he didn't want to just copy Ozzy and make it seem like he was imitating him too much, you know, to fill the shoes. So he did it. So he himself doesn't claim that he started it, but he definitely was instrumental in making it as popular as it is and as iconic as it is today. So also on that note, Gene Simmons, the bassist of Kiss, he tried to trademark the hand sign in 2017. He tried to trademark it. Now, I had heard previously,
sweet Gene,
somewhere that he was not the coolest guy, and I don't remember why, but this tells me that that might have had some truth to it. So he tried to copyright like a hand sign. Imagine somebody
that's like
copyrighting
his whole,
the peace sign.
Right, that's like his whole gimmick though in Kiss though. Like he's the demon, correct? He's that character.
I think so. I've never been a big Kiss fan.
Me neither.
I do think it's Gene Simmons' character rock theme.
I'll Google it while you continue.
While you look at that. So the singer of Coven, actually, Jinx Dawson, at the time that their first album came out in 1969, she was a teenager from Indiana. Which I thought kind of surprising. Not that there's anything wrong with Indiana. I've lived there. Most of my relatives are from there. It's just not necessarily what you expect, you know, for this huge occult theme to just come from a teenager from Indiana.
Gene
right?
Simmons is the demon, by the way. Also, fun fact, Gene Simmons' birth name is Chaim Witz.
Interesting.
Actually, probably Heimwitz, but...
Heimwitz. Throwing fits over not being able to copyright.
Yep.
The devil raising the horns.
Nailed it.
So Jinx Dawson, actually, this again, the singer of Coven, who herself kind of pioneered using raising the horns. She threatened to sue him for trying to sue...
Amazing.
Or for trying to copyright it on behalf of all music fans, because she stated... It was intended to be used for everyone by everyone.
She's truly the Jonas Salk of music.
Yeah, and I thought that was kind of interesting. But so yeah. more to the history. So Coven wasn't a metal band. They were a psychedelic rock primarily. But they were the first in that genre to really bring in the real heavy themes of the occult. And it came from Jinx Dawson's background. Her family... apparently for generations had been members of different secret societies.
Oh.
And could be traced back to the Mayflower Compact.
Whoa.
And other things. So for generations they had been involved in the occult and, you know, subculture, counterculture kind of beliefs in secret societies. And they had taught her all about this, of course, naturally. And so she grew up being really interested and invested in it. So they brought it into their music as Coven. Because they wanted to, she wanted to be able to express both her musical side. Because she was a great pianist too, so she had been raised playing piano, and she wanted to incorporate her musical side with this family history of mm-hmm. dealing with the occult and secrecy and stuff. So therefore, that first album, the last song on the album is a 13-minute musical. Well, it's not that musical. It's I'm trying to think. Rendition isn't the right word, but it's an auditory demonstration of a black mass, which is a gathering of satanic origin for worshiping the devil. So it comprises
interesting.
It's 13 minutes of like chants and satanic prayers,
speaking in tongues and stuff like that.
Exactly, comprised from different sources like books and her own knowledge and so on and so forth. So that was on there. And another fun fact to that album I found is Kurt Cobain and Nirvana have said they said in a 1990 interview that Witchcraft Destroys Minds and Reaps Souls, Coven's debut album, they would listen to while traveling between tour spots.
That's so cool.
Right? And I listened to the album while I was doing this research, and it was kind of interesting. I was more in tune to what I was reading, so I'd have to give it a real listen. But there's definitely some different things that were incorporated other than just the imagery in their sound. So, again, all these weird coincidences with the occult. So they were psychedelic rock with this, but they weren't the first metal band. The first band that's really considered by most to be the first true metal band is, of course, Black Sabbath, Ozzy Osbourne's band, original band. So what's funny about the Coven album is it came out a year before, it came out in 1969, and in 1970 was when Black Sabbath released their debut album, Black Sabbath. So
original.
Right. Where the weird coincidence comes into play is the first song on Coven's album is titled Black Sabbath.
Oh.
And furthermore, their bassist, Greg Osborne, is credited on the album to his nickname, Oz. So it says Black Sabbath as the title, as the first track, and then in the credits it says Oz Osborne.
That's so odd.
Isn't it? This is what I was saying earlier. There's just all these weird coincidences.
That's
that just make
super bizarre.
And talking about these things even more fun. Because it's like, you know, you just raise an eyebrow.
Right.
Probably
yeah.
means nothing. Totally random.
Totally coincidence. Right.
So many random things can somehow fit like dominoes.
This is now a conspiracy theory show. Because I just want to now hear you tell me about conspiracy
right.
theories.
Right. Sure. Maybe another time. But... I find that really interesting, and supposedly they hadn't heard anything. There is some ties between their owning labels,
right?
Having being kind of in business, but I genuinely think it was just one of those
super crazy coincidences.
You know, just
yeah.
really because I looked at the history of Black Sabbath and why they named their band Black Sabbath, and they were originally called Tulka Polk. And the blues or the Tulkapolk Blues, something like that. Then
That's
they changed their name.
A crazy name.
Right? They're from Birmingham, UK. So they, I don't know where that name came from, but then they switched the name to Earth and played some shows. Ozzy has apparently stated he hated that name. But there was another band about the same time that they were starting to emerge as a force in music who was also known as Earth. So they didn't want to have the same name, didn't want to be associated with them, all that jazz. And they were outside of a venue where across the street there was a cinema playing a, I think it was originally an Italian film that's like a little horror compilation film that's called Black Sabbath. And their bassist was, Geezer, was marveling and mentioned to the band how interesting it was that so many people would stand in line and pay money to be frightened. They thought that was kind of, you know, like, that's kind of funny, like, it is, interesting, right?
I agree, actually. That's right? Insane.
It's interesting. And fun fact about that movie, Black Sabbath, actually inspired Quentin Tarantino to write Pulp Fiction because Pulp Fiction to follow a similar kind of narrative style.
Interesting.
Yeah, totally weird, but I thought that was interesting enough to mention. So they saw that, and they had been experimenting with their sound some. And one thing that's unfortunate towards Coven, where they were the origin of kind of this occult theme being pervasive in rock and metal, similar to Robert Johnson, they're not very well known.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of that is because after their initial album came out in 1969, that was right around the time frame that the Manson murders scare was happening.
Yeah.
And for any listeners not familiar, I don't think I should explain the whole thing, but look it up. You'll find information instantly. The Manson murders, basically Charlie Manson, very influential figure in Hollywood and California, had a cult, the Manson family. They carried out some murders.
Cult leader is more what he
right.
is. But
it was very, I mean, it was awful what the things they did. And so it's understandable that there was a nationwide scare about this kind of thing. And they were very associated with the occult and stuff right at the same time. So there was a picture that came out during the scare of Charles Manson outside an LA record store holding a copy of Coven's debut album.
Oh no.
Right?
Shit.
So
that sucks
people,
so bad.
People made this conclusion that they were connected, although the band states they never knew Manson, never, they had no connection to him. But the association was there. The album actually ended up being pulled off the market for many years. And because of that, and Black Sabbath's rise right around the same time frame, even though they aren't directly related, other mm-hmm. than just having similar interests, I suppose, they were the ones that, it's not that they got credit and Coven doesn't for the same thing. Coven really introduced the occult into rock and made it more pervasive. Black Sabbath created the genre of metal, pretty much. So they it's not a matter of one having credit for something else somebody did, as more weirdly two things kind of combined separately at the same time and created what we know now.
Right. Except for Gene Simmons.
Right.
Trying to take credit because fuck Gene Simmons, I guess.
Right? Yeah. No, let's punk him all day. I don't know if he's done anything else. Maybe he's a super nice guy outside of that. I honestly don't know.
Jesus.
But trying to copyright a hand sign, that's asinine.
It's ridiculous.
That is asinine. So anyway, back to what I was saying about Sabbath, right? So Black Sabbath decided that they wanted to change their sound. They were experimenting with things. And they wrote a song that they named after the movie and the little experience that they had with that, where they had experimented with a darker sound. They incorporated tritones, which is known as the devil's interval,
mm-hmm.
classically, because way back when, if you played that interval, you could be put to death because it was dissonant. It's the most dissonant.
Right.
I can't think of the word, but it's a really dissonant sound. And so that was considered bad in medieval times. So if you did that, you might get your head chopped off because it's associated with the devil, right? Fun stuff. Those medieval times.
Yeah,
so they used tritones, and they named that song Black Sabbath, both because of the little experience with the movie and supposedly their bassist had had a vision of a black silhouetted figure at the foot of his bed right around that time, and they just kind of ran with it. They really wanted this darker sound and liked it, and they thought there would be a really good market for it based on Coven. You know, horror movies. And well, they didn't know about Coven,
right? Yeah, but just, yes, based on horror movies, yeah,
right. So they named their band when they wanted to change from Earth, because again, they didn't want to be associated with the other band named that. So they named themselves after the song that they composed that changed their sound, and they continued on with that sound to be the band that is known today as, you know, the founders of metal. So they're not the only ones. There's definitely plenty of other players in the game, so to speak. Like Alice Cooper is a really good mention. He started up and didn't get popularity right away. His popularity came more towards the latter half of the 70s. Mm-hmm. But he incorporated occult themes as a gimmick, mostly. Cooper and his band realized that the concept of a male playing the role of a villain, a woman killer, in tattered woman's clothing, wearing makeup, would cause social controversy and get headlines, and they really wanted attention because they had been playing in California for a while and not been getting good reception. They moved back to Detroit, where I believe Cooper, or that's not his born name, but he did adopt that name later on, was from originally. And, you know, they were able to stand out more in a market that wasn't so associated with like the hippie peace and love culture and stuff. And they were big and influential as a part of that glam rock sort of, you know, where like that Kiss is a part of too.
Right. Yeah.
And then kind of inspired more like hair metal and like a lot of glam rock things, so on. But Black Sabbath really did start metal.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe there would be a lot more to it, but it's kind of that simple. It seems there's not a lot of scholarly research done into the topic, and
not a lot of peer-reviewed articles.
I did find a book called Season of the Witch that I'm interested in reading.
Oh.
And there was a few articles. I mean, when I originally typed in Google, you know, the history of devil themes in metal, it was like a bunch of Christian and other religious websites being negative towards the music and stating why it was bad and so on.
I wonder if that Season of the Witch book is a reference to the Donovan song Season of the Witch.
It could be. But so what's interesting as well, and does still tie to Robert Johnson, big, huge influence for Jimi Hendrix, as one example, in the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the artists that influenced Black Sabbath really heavily, Jimi Hendrix, Cream, who was a band from Eric Clapton, or had Eric Clapton as a member.
Associated, yeah. Who is Eric Clapton is someone who has credited Johnson as a major inspiration.
Right. And Led Zeppelin.
Yep.
And Led Zeppelin is, they were not metal, but they are very much in part responsible for the molding of harder rock into metal. Yeah. It's just that, you know, like I was saying, it's kind of weird and nebulous in some sense, but it's pretty simple, right? Like, they helped inspire a heavier sound. Black Sabbath was inspired by these horror themes and kind of ran with that. And then that got some popularity, and other artists like Kiss and Alice Cooper saw the value and shock factor. And you know, more contemporary example, Marilyn Manson, who did it explicitly to be very in the face of people.
Provocative, yeah.
Right? Yeah, that's the perfect word.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting because, like, these things, I think, largely do, or not necessarily largely, but I do think a lot of these can be traced back to Johnson and the legend about Robert Johnson. Like you just did it, basically. You were like, all right, Black Sabbath was inspired by this person who was inspired by this person who was inspired by Johnson. Like, even if that is more of a musical inspiration, I feel that the idea of devil worship or selling your soul to the devil or the occult, broadly speaking, seeing how Johnson became famous to people who weren't musicians because of that myth, like that is an easy jump to make, like, oh, okay, well, maybe that'll work for us, you know, like,
right,
maybe those ideas work in music, broadly speaking, in rock.
And you stated, did you say earlier that the myth probably came up about during the 70s.
That yeah, Robert it wasn't did. It wasn't around the time he died, to my understanding. And, it was around the like 60s, 70s.
Right, and
like,
that's the exact time frame, 1969 through the mid to late 70s, when these occult themes and
exactly
and pervasive evil and dark things like molded right. and changed it. Some people think it saved the genre in some ways because it changed its sound. Like I know that if it weren't for the British invasion, a lot of people think rock and roll as a genre would have just dead stopped, totally. Been I mean, like done. But it's just, it's kind of interesting, like you're, how all of these things
kind of seem to tie related, back.
But right. I mean, it doesn't not make sense, right? It's music.
Right.
Music begets music, right? But it's just funny, right? This British invasion and then Black Sabbath wasn't part of that. I don't think Black Sabbath is considered part of the British invasion.
No, it's like the Stones and
but they Blend came after and... that, inspired by some of that, were a British band who then became the pioneers of metal.
Right.
And that was introduced by an American band of all things and stuff. It's really weird.
Yeah, it seems that one of the things that's really, I love tracing these themes through like the complicated nebulous web of music and in different time periods and stuff, but it's interesting how pervasive the theme of the occult is in a lot of rock. Like it travels from like blues to rock to hard rock and into things like punk. Like if you think about the Misfits, for example, a very, very influential old punk band from the 80s, their whole shtick is like dark skulls, you know, greasy hair and black makeup and stuff like that. So like it's not really explicitly the occult the way that Black Sabbath is, but it still takes a lot of tonal notes from things like that.
It's a part of the whole desire to set yourself apart from normal right. society and be a subculture that is part of it. I mean, if you look at like early, I think, well, literally their first album, Black Sabbath.
That's my favorite Sabbath. Album. Black Sabbath.
Back Sabbath. I mean, critically, it was torn apart. You know, really? The critics at the time were like, "What is this garbage?" Pretty much. That's but it was. So funny. But despite that, it was popular because people really liked this different and darker sound because it was, you know, different. And not everybody can claim to be it, but plenty of us like things that are different or, you know, show right. us something we're not familiar with. But since it's old, it then molded and just continued to be that way. And then it's mm-hmm. just kind of become ingrained in such a way that you can't take it apart. And like you're saying with right. Misfits, with the skulls and stuff, it's not necessarily a cult, but it is
just dark.
It's like it's cut from the same cloth. You exactly. know, it's just like, look at yeah. me, I'm different. You know, you're happy there's... over there, I'm sad. You know what I mean? really reduce it.
Based... Yeah. If you reduce it that way to just this idea of dark, like there is this like dark variant of all rock, I feel like. Like you've got, my go-to is always to think about punk music because I find that very fascinating. But like you've got a band like The Clash who like aren't really a dark band, they're more political than anything, and a lot of punk bands from the era are. But then you also have Misfits who are, I'm not a big Misfits scholar or anything, but my understanding is that they're more dark, like you know and that, you know, even traces into grunge, like mm-hmm. that just not even a cult at all, but like really dark, upsetting things. Like Nirvana actually has a song called Rape Me, like that's yeah. really upsetting. The Pixies, like the shirt I'm wearing right now that you can see Storm, all of their music is really dark and upsetting. Like that's their shtick, you know?
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned grunge, because actually a lot of people think that Black Sabbath was very influential into the creation of grunge. Well, of yeah. course, their music wasn't grunge, but part of that sound yeah. was borrowed and used in its own way to become grunge. And well, yeah. the blues connection too, one thing that I didn't mention earlier was I did say that Coven was more on the psychedelic rock spectrum, but mm-hmm. psychedelic rock, or at least their version of it, was very heavily inspired by blues. I mean, mm-hmm. look at Jimi Hendrix, right? And a lot of the blues that inspired it goes back to the Delta blues of Robert Johnson. And the whole thing, the way that things that aren't necessarily like met face to face, but come up about the same time, it reminds me of this theory that my guitar teacher had. And I've never been able to explain it quite as well as he could, but the general idea was that, like, these ideas that are very influential and change things, right? Like new genres of music or like Microsoft or something, right? Like the universe itself kind of, it's almost like they're like radio waves, right? Like yeah. There's some sort of waveform that's sent out by the universe. And like, by that notion, it's going to happen at some point, right? Like it's something that humanity or whatever is meant to do. But the people who end up doing it, they just happen to have, so to speak, their brains in, right? Calibrated to the right signal or the right frequency.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that it comes to. Just like I said, Coven, Black Sabbath, not related, but somehow right in the same year, it all culminated to form what we see now.
Yeah. Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. Basically, this, to sum it up, Robert Johnson is the reason that grunge exists, right? Like that's the main takeaway, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much for tuning into another episode of Out of Phase. I'm glad we're back. Thank you, Storm, for coming on and you know talking about the devil with me for like 45 minutes.
Thanks for letting me.
Thanks for letting you talk about
one of my favorite bands.
Yes, of course. That's the real reason that we do this show, is that so I can talk about my favorite bands and give other people a chance to do it under the guise of some sort of like educational book. No, I'm kidding.
Sure.
Thanks for tuning in. We will be back at the beginning of December with another episode. I'm really excited about that. Couple things before we head out. Remember to vote. First of all, please vote. It's important. You will have, I think, literally one day to do it by the time this podcast comes out. So please, 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 if you haven't voted, vote. And, you know, be nice to people, wear a mask, be a good person. Thanks for tuning in. I will see you next month with another episode of Out of Phase.